Good afternoon. So last time we talked about the FAT file system. Mentioned that we have this header that we store near the beginning of the disk that sort of global and general information, like we had this choice of how big clusters were, we had a location of the root directory on the disk, and other sort of global information about the file system, but we need it in a well-known location. We'll see that this is a very common pattern for lots of file systems. We saw that the file system divided up the disk into clusters, which is where the data was stored. And these clusters were possibly larger than a sector because we didn't want it to be coupled to the size the hardware chose. Sometimes we wanted a larger size to deal with for our bookkeeping. And our files and directories data would always be stored in some number of whole clusters, one or more, depending on the size of the file or directory. And we had a linked list identifying what those clusters were. And to represent that linked list, we used the file allocation table. We had one number we stored for every cluster that could store data, and these either served as the next pointers for a linked list or for clusters that weren't currently being used to store file or directory data for information like that this cluster is free. Mentioned that we have directory entries. So we needed to store information about files besides the actual data in them. And we also need to store the contents of directories. And our solution for this is we have directory entries which make up the data for directories. And these store for things that are in a directory, the starting location for the data of that thing, and the name of that thing, and other metadata about it. Okay. Some questions about things we covered last time? Yes. Question 1B on the quiz. Okay, so on this question, we said we had a device that was a network device controller, and this device has an input and output buffer on it. And the input buffer stores, in this case, messages that come from the network that the OS hasn't processed yet. And the output buffer stores messages from the OS, which the device hasn't processed yet. And this question was asking, during the exception handler, when the device tells us it's ready for data, would we copy from the input to the output buffer? And that doesn't seem very likely, because we're sending stuff back on the network as is that we got in. I agree, it's not impossible to do that, and that might not be 100% unreasonable, but that doesn't seem like a typical operation of our network driver. Yes, back there. Can I go over 3 and 4? Sure. So 3 and 4, we're asking, we had a FAT file system. And in 3, we said the file system, we had a root directory with 16 text files, which stored 1,500 bytes of text. So to store those files, we're going to need to reserve some number of clusters. And remember, we said we're going to reserve one or more whole clusters for the data for that. And our clusters are 1,024 bytes, so we need 2 of them. One is not enough, 2 is enough. So each of those 16 files, we're going to reserve 2 whole clusters for, even though we're not going to use all of the second cluster. In fact, we're not going to use most of the second cluster. So that's where we get 2 clusters we're going to reserve per file, plus 16 files, times 16 files. So that's 32 clusters for the actual text in the files. And also, we need to have a root directory that points to those files. And that's where our metadata about the files is going to go. And that's going to be, again, in data clusters. And we're going to need 16 directory entries, which is going to take 16 times 32 bytes, which is much less than 1,024 bytes. So we should be able to store that all in one cluster. So we have one extra cluster for the directory. That's how I got 33 clusters. And we were talking about outside the FAT and disk headers. So when we set this up, we're also going to need to edit FAT entries to say, if I have a text file that takes up 2 clusters, after the first cluster you go here, and after the second cluster you have nowhere to go. But that's not part of this number because we said outside of the fat and outside of the disk numbers. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Can I go back to question one? Sure.
It makes sense to me that the bottom half controller might wake up a process that's in the middle of a write system call, a read system call, like there's nothing in the buffer and
yes.
the network to receive the packet. But for write, why would it not be the case that it would just write in the kernel buffer and then be done with that?
So the question is, why would we wake up in the middle of a write system call? So if the write system call was waiting for there to be more buffer space, that would be the case in which we do it. And that would be the typical case in which a write system call would go to sleep, is if it ran out of buffer, if there's no buffer space to do the write right now, we could wait.
By the top half.
Why isn't that done by the top? So the top half is put, so the question is, why isn't that done by the top half? So the top half did the operation of putting the write to sleep. The bottom half is responsible for waking it up.
So once it pulls some data out of the kernel buffer, then it would notify that process that there's space.
Question, once it pulls data out, it would notify the waiting process in their space? Yes. And that's the operation we're referring to in option C. Yes?
Yes. Question about choice B here. So, like, from the lecture slide, the bottom half, like, exception handler also sends like, additional data back to the device controller, like there's an arrow.
The question is choice, which choice?
Choice B.
Choice B?
Yeah. So, could you upload the lecture slide where it shows, like, the bottom half?
Not quickly, but this is choice B. This is copying from the input to the output buffer, right? So if we look at the description here of what the input and output buffer are, these are storing things that we receive or sent from the device. So that operation is saying, I want to send out on the device something that I received on it.
So when the exception happens and the exception handler wants to
right. So question is, isn't the exception handler responsible for sending additional data from the device? Yes. But it's going to get that data typically from a kernel buffer of data that's waiting to go out on the device. Does that answer your question? It's not going to typically echo back what the device sent to the device. Okay, back there. So question four, why each subdirectory for clusters? So each subdirectory contains 100 text files. So we need 3,200 bytes of space for that, which is slightly larger than three clusters. So it's going to be at least four clusters. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Can I go over 2B? So the question is, in addition to copying data to the kernel buffer before returning, write system calls would also need to wait until the device received the data before returning when they would not previously. So we're saying previously, the write system call, if the kernel buffer had space, it copied data there and said, I'm done. And the argument is, do we need to change this behavior with direct memory access? And the answer is no. We can do the exact same thing we did before, of once the kernel buffer is full, it's someone else's problem to make sure that gets to the device, and that's going to be the responsibility of the device copying from our kernel buffer and the bottom half of the device driver setting up that copy to happen if it needs to be triggered by the device being ready. The same as before, we would have the bottom half like copy to the device directly. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so some logistical things. So on paging protection, so I had hoped that my tests would be a little better at avoiding debugging issues than they were. I guess I didn't think hard enough about what happens when people break basic functionality and how those tests don't work as well as I, like they worked more often than previously, but there were still more cases that they didn't consider. And also apparently the advice to run tests without the shell was usually not something that students paid attention to. Probably some assignment organization considering. Because we had his physical page free, a lot more students than usual tried modifying K-free. And that's probably the most elegant solution, but it's also, if something goes wrong, the hardest to debug approach. Like, it's the least code, but if something goes wrong, the most things fail, because boot doesn't work often. Okay, and another thing is office hour queues. There were complaints about them, and quite legitimately, and basically, we were spending, mostly TAs, because I don't hold as many office hours as them, too much time per student, and we just can't spend 15 minutes with you if there's one TA and 15 students waiting. That is not something we can do. And TAs and I sometimes have trouble switching away from students because that's what we're supposed to do in those cases. And we're also probably supposed to say that, hey, if we solve your first problem, you have a new problem, we're going to probably have to tell you, hey, go to debugging that because I have 10 people to talk to. And that often wasn't happening. And I know there's complaints about, couldn't you tweak the queue ordering? And yes, I could, but no amount of tweaking the queue ordering is going to make the office hour queue work if there's 15 people waiting and we're spending 20 minutes per student with one TA. You know, just putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. We could also be probably more useful if we had better requests. I had lots of people coming to me in office hours where they didn't know what code was running of their code and didn't seem to make attempts to like do debug prints or debugger stuff to figure that out. And inevitably, the first thing I have to tell them is, well, I need to know that to help you with your problem. I'm not just going to look at it hangs and guess which of 10 different things you did. And we also need to get just better at switching between students faster. So I know that was not great, and partly because I hoped the debugging would be a little less harrowing. Yes, question.
This is sort of unrelated, but have you figured out the final format yet?
Have I figured out the final format? I'm not yet. I will figure out exactly what I'm doing for that soon. Okay, so we talked about FAT. I want to talk about another file system. We'll go with the type of file system XP6 has, which is very similar to the sort of file system that you'll see on a modern Unix system. And it's better at some things than FAT, worse at other things, perhaps. It's definitely more complicated. So we're going to talk about how that works. I'm going to go with the disk layout. So XP6 and generally Unix file systems have some things that are very much like what FAT does, but just have different names. So for example, XP6 and most Unix file systems call the things they divide the disk into blocks instead of clusters, just a difference in name. They also have a header, and the common name you'll see for that is a superblock. So that's the header, and it has sort of general information, kind of like we saw in FAT. In this case, we don't like have the block size because that's just hard-coded. But we have like the number of blocks and the size of various other things in this structure. So unlike FAT, where we have basically a FAT table and the rest of the disk is just clusters, here we have more pieces we divide the disk into, and I'm going to go into them. So we have this thing called an inode array. And an inode is going to represent all the information about a file except its name. So in XP6, that's just the file type. If it's a device file, so remember we can have files that represent devices. It also has the identifier of which device driver to use for it. And we have its size, like in FAT, it's not, but this is not stored in the directory entry. We have a separate place for that information. And we have the actual location of the data. And unlike FAT, this is not going to be a linked list. This is going to be an array. We have an array of where the blocks for the file are. And you might say, wait a moment, this array is fixed size. Isn't that a problem? We're going to talk about how we deal with large files in a bit. But there's going to be some sort of special case for large files. But for small files, everything just fits in this array. We don't have to traverse a linked list. We also track the information about what blocks are free, but since we don't have something like a FAT, that's tracked separately, and we just have a bitmap where we just have one bit per each block in the rest of the disk, indicating is it used or is it free. And if we want to allocate a new block, we just scan this for zeros, basically. And you might say, how do we know what inodes are free? XP6's solution is that we scan for type equals zero. Often, file systems will have a separate, similar free inode map, where we'll say, this index in the inode array is unused, same as we had like one bit per each block to indicate whether it's free or not. Yes?
I'm sorry, can you explain one more time what an inode is?
An inode is all the information about a file except the name.
Except for?
The name. Yes? Question, how does this relate to clusters, the inode?
Right, it's like how does this layout like relate to the layout that we want to overlap with like clusters?
How does this relate to the layout we want to overlap with clusters? So like that, most of our disk is going to be for storing data. Okay. It's just that rather than just having a single table for everything else, we have an inode array to have the sort of file data, including where the files are stored, and a free block to indicate what blocks are free in the data portion.
So how is the inode array any different than the header for the FAT?
How is it different than the header for, how is this different from the header for the FAT? So the thing that's analogous to our header for the FAT is this super block here. The inode array is an array. So there is one of these for every single file in this array. And this array is also created when we format the disk. So if it's not big enough for the number of files we want, well, that's too bad. Okay. So we have our free block map. Okay. So if we have all our information about files except the name in this array, where we have one entry for each file with all that information, I'd say, what do directory entries look like? And in XV6, directory entries are an index in that array and a name. That's it. So all the other data about files, including their size, are going to be stored in that inode. Also, a consequence of this is that we can actually have two different directory entries in different directories that reference literally the same file. That they should have the same index. And that is allowed, that's called a hard link. Each reference is called a hard link, and we have multiple of them. And this is why in the inode data, we have this end link thing here, which tracks how many links there are to a file. So we can know when we can free it. Yes?
So where do the directories live? Are they contained in the inode array, or do they live somewhere else in the disk?
So question, where do the directories live? So like FAT, the directories are going to be regular files, except their data is directory entry array instead of text or something like that.
So they're in the inode array?
So the directories are going to be files in the inode array, and their data, their directory entries, are going to be in the data portion of the disk. So we're still going to have that strategy of having just a list of directory entries as our directories data. Yes? Question, do we actually use inodes in FAT? No. So in FAT, like the data for the stuff that's in this inode is kind of split in different places. So in FAT, like our directory entry has the size and it has the first block, and the later blocks we have to go to the FAT. So an inode is a different way of organizing that. Yes?
So is the data that is contained in a directory? directory entry in the inode array? Or is the actual data in the data block associated with?
Question, is the data that's contained in the directory entry? So directory entries are in the data portion of the disk.
And are those directory entries themselves inodes?
Question, are those directory entries inodes? No, they just have the index of an inode. And a name. Yes?
So there's no central directory that houses all the entries that are just scattered around the disk?
Question, there's no central directory that houses all the entries. The entries are just scattered around the disk. So a single directory's entries will be in a list of blocks, just like in fact. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
What's the difference between a data block and a cluster?
What's the difference between data block and a cluster? They are essentially the same thing, with different names. So if you read Unix documentation, they'll always use the term block and never use the term cluster. If you read FAT documentation, they'll always use the term cluster and never use the term block, but they essentially mean the same thing.
So are we looking into this different way of representing things just to better understand how it works in XV6? Or?
So question, are we looking at this different way of understanding things to better understand how it works in XV6? Or is other reasons? So partly because it's in XV6, but partly because there are some choices that XV6 file systems make, which are probably better file system design, or at least other file system designs that have advantages over FAT, maybe also disadvantages, that are worth talking about. Other questions? Yeah. So question, will a regular text file have a directory entry at the beginning of the addresses array? No. So for a regular text file, addresses of 0 for its inode, would point to its text. The directory entry for it, like in FAT, would be in its directory, which would be pointed to by a different inode for its directory. Other questions? Is it the same type of linked list thing? No. So for example, if our inode uses block 11 and block 14 for its data, adder 0 will be 11 and adders 1 will be 14 in this array in the inode. And we'll look at that in more detail in a bit. Okay. And so we talked about directory entries. When we went to allocate inodes or blocks, we scan the block free map for zeros, we scan inodes for free ones, and XV6 just takes the first thing that's free. You want to know a concrete strategy for that, that's simple. So why would we prefer this strategy to what FAT does? So one thing is that we're going to talk later, XV6 has some support for reliability. It'll be a different topic, we'll get to that later. It's possibly easier to do allocate blocks because we have this free block map that's much more compact than the FAT entries, which are like 4 bytes per block, so we have much less to scan to find a free block. It's easier to find the location of something in the middle of a file because we can use an array lookup rather than a linked list traversal. And the file type and size information is held together with most of the block locations. So when we're actually opening or reading a file, we have less to keep track of. We don't have to go to a directory entry and the FAT. We just get the inode number from a directory entry and we just use that inode for all our operations after a file is open. Okay, so let's talk about where data is stored. So we mentioned inodes have this array of the blocks. And what XV6 does is the first 12 blocks of a file are pointed to directly by that array. We'll call these direct blocks. And then we have an indirect pointer, which points to a block, which is going to be in the data section, where rather than storing actual file data there, we just store another array of block numbers. And this is how we deal with, some files are more than 12 blocks long, right? Or more than 13 blocks long, how do we use a 13 entry array for that? If the file's more than 12 blocks long, we have this extra layer of indirection. So questions? Yes?
So
So instead of using a greater size for the address array, we're just going to use the last entry in the address array to map to more.
So the question is, instead of using a greater size for the array, we're just going to use the last entry to map to more? Yes. And importantly, for small files, we won't even allocate that more block. We'll just put the equivalent of a null pointer at the end. Yes?
And is that because we have to keep the address array as a constant size?
Question, is that because we have to keep the address array as a constant size? Yeah. So if you remember that it's going to be stored in this sort of statically outlocated array on disk, which we're going to set up at format time. So we can't change the size of that very easily after we set it. Yes?
So is it like the first block is 12 and then the next one can be however long it needs to be, or is it like 12, 12, 12?
So the question is, so the first block is 12? What do you mean?
So the first direct block, there are 12 direct blocks. Right?
Yes, and the first one's at index 0.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the indirect block of direct blocks, is that constrained also by 12, or can that be?
So question is, the indirect block of direct blocks, what's the size of that? Okay, so this is going to be a block. So it's going to be the size of a, so the number of entries here is going to be the size of a block divided by the size of a number. Because each entry in here is a number. Does that answer your question?
What if the file exceeds that?
Question, what if the file exceeds that? XV6 answer is too bad. We'll have a more satisfying answer in a bit. Yes? Why do we have an indirect block? We need an indirect block of the 12 index. So we want an indirect block because there's not enough space in the direct blocks. Right? There's not enough space in the statically sized array. We're putting it at the end because for small files, we don't want to have to worry about having indirect blocks at all. So we just say statically that the first 12 entries of the array never are indirect. But for large files, we'll start using some of the entries as indirect because it's not, those first 12 aren't going to be good enough. Yes? The array, question, the array can only be 12 index? Yes, because this is, we define the array size when we format the disk. When we set up the disk initially, we set how big items are, and we're stuck with that decision unless we want to rearrange all the data on the disk. Yes?
So is this indirect block dynamically allocated?
Question, is this indirect block dynamically allocated? Yes. So this is going to be allocated only if we need it. Just like when we store a file, we're going to allocate a block. Same mechanism is going to be used to allocate this metadata block. Yes?
In the denominator, when you say size of number, what is that number?
Size of a block number. So if you think of our adders, right, we have this uint pointing to them. So one of those, presumably. Whatever we need to have one of these entries in the array, this extension to the array. Yes?
I still don't get exactly why you're dividing it and what that number is supposed to be.
Question, why am I dividing it? So this whole thing is the size of a block.
Yeah.
So let's say a block is 1,024 bytes, and each entry is one number.
Yeah.
And let's say the number is 2 bytes, then we have 512 extra array elements that we can store there. And that would be how much extra space we get. So as a concrete example, in XV6, blocks are 512 bytes, that's just hard-coded, and block pointers are 2 bytes. So those numbers, each entries in those arrays, are 2 bytes on disk. So we have 256 block pointers fit in that indirect block. Just 512 divided by 2, that's how many elements I can have in that extra space I add on. So I only allocate one block for that. So how much storage can we, how big can a file get? Well, we can have 12 direct blocks, each of which points to 512 bytes of the file's data. And I can have one indirect block, which points to an extra 128K of the file, and that gives us our maximum file size. Assuming I did this calculation correctly. Yeah. Question, how do I decide whether or not I need an indirect block or a direct block? If my file, so this is always the first block of my file. And this is always the 12th block of my file. If I go beyond that, I need an indirect block. If I don't, I do not. So my file has 12 blocks or less. I don't need an indirect block because I'm not using the 13th entry of the adders array. Otherwise, I do.
I don't know whether to give it to 0 or to 12.
How do I know whether to put the indirect block in 0 or 12? It's always in 12. No exceptions. That is always indirect. I can't choose anything else. Even if the file is exactly 13 blocks, sorry, you have to allocate a full block to store one block number. Because it's always indirect. Yes?
Can you go to the slide you were on before this one?
Here?
Yes.
Yeah.
So why does pointing to an indirect block, like isn't that the same, won't that give you, I'm confused why you don't just get another 6,144 bytes. I'm confused about why you get
it. So question, why don't I just get another 6,144 bytes? Yeah. Because the size of this array here is not another copy of the adders array.
Okay.
It's just a new array that's as big as we can fit in a block. So the inodes are much smaller than a block. Yes. Question, should I evenly distribute the new ones amongst the 12? We'll talk about why we've chosen this design over putting the indirect pointers more evenly over like a more tree-like data structure in a bit. Right, I think you're saying, oh, we should have like an evenly distributed tree rather than here we have like sort of we have like a tree data structure, but it's sort of very lopsided, right? That's what your complaint is? Question, also why don't we add more to adders? We'll talk about justifications for that in a bit. Why this design was chosen. So first, I'm going to go over our issue that this seems too small, and it probably seems extra too small because I think I made a mistake, and actually block pointers are 4 bytes in our version of XP6 and not 2. So it's even smaller. So let's talk about a more real example. So Linux Extended 2 uses a similar organization, the Extended 2 file system, I should say, on Linux, on which some more recent Linux file systems are based. So the inode has more data, so it has sort of user IDs, it has modification and access times, it has group IDs, and some other information. But essentially the organization is the same, including having some equivalent of the adders array, where are the data for the file stored. And there's more indirection supported here, so we can support bigger files, because we're not going to be satisfied with the sort of file sizes we get from an indirect pointer. And what they just do is they just do extra indirection that's similar. So we have our first 12 blocks work the same way as XP6. And in fact, our 13th block also works the same way. We have a block that points to, here, a block of pointers, right? Just an extra array, the size of a block on the disk, just of more block numbers, of extending that array. But after that, we say, okay, well, if that wasn't enough, what I could do is I could just have another block of pointers, but my file sizes could be much, much larger than supported, so I'm going to handle much, much larger file sizes by having a block of pointers to more blocks of pointers, what we'll call a double indirect block. And if that's not good enough, I'm going to have an extra entry in the array where I'm going to have a block of pointers that points to blocks of pointers that points to blocks of pointers. So that should store even more stuff. And the hope is that even if our file is really, really huge, that last entry will take care of it. But for smaller files, the earlier entries will be all we'll need and our accesses will be simpler. Right? We don't want to do this 3 layers of indirection all the time. We only want to do it for files that are big enough for it to be worthwhile. So for small files, we're not going to have that. So we have our blocks, data pointers, and our data blocks here. And again, the first block of the file here, second, third, it's still in that same order. So we have 12 direct pointers, an indirect pointer that points to more direct pointers, essentially. We have a double indirect pointer, which points to more indirect pointers, which point to blocks of direct pointers, and a triple indirect pointer. And if that wasn't good enough for us still, we could have a quadruple indirect pointer. Yes?
So how do you know to stop at having a triple indirect pointer?
Question, how do we know to stop at having a triple indirect pointer? Well, let's see. How big can we get a file? Say we have 1 kilobyte blocks and 4 byte block numbers. And let's compute the size we get and see if that sounds big enough. Yes? Can I go to the previous slide? Question is iBlock. iBlock, this is part of the I stands for inode. This is in the inode. So we have 12 direct and a bunch of indirect. And XV6, sorry, Linux just chose a different size, right, for this array. So question, remember we got XV12? The question is, how do we size the array, adders or iBlock? So we have to choose a size when we format the disk. And XV6 chooses 12. Linux searches 13 entries for the array. And Linux chose a bigger number. But we have to fix that number when we format the disk. So we can adjust it. We could choose some other number other than 12, but we have to choose it at one time. We can't adjust it per file. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question is, the ext2 inode stuff, am I only showing it for the double and triple indirect?
Yeah.
That's the primary way in which it differs from XV6.
Oh, this is just a different way of representing the inode.
Yes. This is just a more, this is the Linux version of an inode, which has this double and triple indirect stuff, which XV6 chose not to do. So, question here is, how big can we store? So, we have this layers of indirection. How big can a file be given this?
Thank you. 256 times 1n. You can put your 256 blocks, and each block gets you a little by your size. So you get 256 times
with the zero
at the second level. No, just 256 bytes times 1 kilobyte. So 256 kilobytes at the second level.
Okay, so okay, so who thinks that it would be less than a gigabyte? Between 1 and 4 gigabytes. Okay, a couple people. Between 4 and 8. 8 and 16 gigabytes. Okay, a few people. 16 and 32. Okay, 32 and 64. More than 64 gigabytes. Okay, so it looks like most people got, I think, roughly the right area. So I get about, it's a little more than 16 gig or so, around 16 gig. So what happens is our first 12 kilobytes of the file are going to be stored in our direct pointers. And we're not going to use any of the indirect, double indirect, triple indirect if the file is that small. Then we have a block that the indirect pointer can point to. It's 1 kilobyte. And the pointers are 4 bytes, so it's going to store 256 more pointers. So that's going to be the next 256 kilobytes of the file. Why 256 kilobytes? 256 blocks that are pointed to times 1 kilobyte per block. So that's our next 256K of the data. For the double indirect pointer, we'll have another block pointing to more pointers. Each of those pointers, based on what happened with the indirect pointer, represents another 256K of data. We have 256 of them. So that's going to be the next 256 times 256 kilobytes of the file. And similarly, our triple indirect is going to be the following 256 times 256 times 256 kilobytes of the file. And assuming I used my calculator correctly, I got about 16 gig is the amount of space that gives us. And so if you were deciding whether this was a good arrangement, you'd say, well, is that a good number? And if it wasn't, you could add a quadruple indirect block. You could adjust the block size. So if it makes the block size 2 kilobytes instead of 1, this number gets a lot bigger. Or something like that. Or make other adjustments to like the number of pointers, some other way. Some questions on how I did this computation. Yes?
How do you still figure out whether
or not to use a quadruple? Well, that's going to be a decision I make when I format the disk, right? Because I need to add an entry to the array for a quadruple indirect pointer under the scheme, right? Because every pointer in the inode is fixed purpose. It's either direct or indirect or double indirect or triple indirect. There's no changing. And what I would say when formatting the disk, I say, gosh, 16 gigabytes, that seems too small. Let's add another entry to each inode, even though that's going to use a bit of space to support bigger files. Because if I add a quadruple indirect, that's going to add 256 to the fourth bytes of kilobytes of data. That's going to be probably big enough for any disk I have. Yes?
Would you still have a file allocation table if you're storing the blocks using this array?
Question, would I still have a file allocation table if I'm storing the blocks using this array? No, there is no file allocation table in this style of file system.
Well, why are we storing using this?
Question, why are we storing using this mechanism rather than the file allocation table? So one advantage of this is that I have to go to less parts of the disk to figure out where a file is stored. Like, even though, yes, it's not all in one place, it's still less scattered than the FAT mechanism. Another advantage is that if I want to go to a particular byte of the file, that's going to be a lot easier. So, for example, let's say I want to find byte 2 to the 15 of a file. With the FAT, I'm going to have to traverse the entire linked list till I get there. And we're going to be able to actually say where we find it, and that's next exercise. So where would I find it? And I'm going to be able to figure out which pointer I look at, and if it's an indirect pointer, like where do I look at in the array I find there? Unlike the FAT, where I have to go through everything previously, which is a lot slower for reading from the middle of a file. So a question here is, same sort of setup, how do I find byte 2 to the 15 of the file? Where do I read the location of that from? Question? No, okay. Give people a little bit of time. So do I use an indirect or double indirect pointer for it? Based on the file size computation, you should guess we probably don't need the triple indirect. And what index do I look in when I go through one of those indirect pointers?
Thank you.
or not even the first one, just the first 12 rows.
Okay, who? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's say, who thinks we use the indirect pointer, the single indirect pointer? Thinks we use the double indirect pointer? Thinks we use one of the direct pointers? Okay, so we have agreement, both plurality agreement on indirect pointer. So how about what index? So who thinks we use an index between 0 and 10 in the thing that's pointed to by the indirect pointer? Between 10 and 20? Okay. Between 20 and 30? Okay. Over 30? Okay. So we have, I think, some of the calculations might be a bit different, but we have rough consensus on sort of where the answer is. So this points to a block. So the way I would visualize this is, if we think of byte 2 to the 15, that's 2 to the 5 blocks into the file, because each block is 2 to the 10 bytes. So it's block 32 we want to get to. Blocks 0 through 11, we have these direct pointers to. Then we have an indirect pointer, and index 0 of this thing this points to is going to be block 12, index 1 is block 13, all the way up to 255 is going to be block 12 plus 255. And we want block 32 in here, so block 32 is going to be index 32 minus 12. Yes. What question? Why do I have up to 255? Because we learned earlier that we have 256 pointers, and I'm indexing starting with 0.
So the two questions are related.
Yes, the two questions are related. Yes, because it's the same size block pointers, same size block, same size block numbers, same parts of the inode. Yes. Question, is this the file system of x86? This is like a version of the Linux file system, of a Linux file system.
What do you mean the file system of an operating system? Does it mean
so Linux supports a lot of file systems. This is like one of the ones it supports. Okay, so we see, I think we have a reasonable understanding of this organization, and let's talk about why did we choose to do that. And if you look at file sizes, and so here's some data from 2000. I'm sorry, I don't have something more recent. People don't do these studies very often. Of file sizes at a big company, and actually several places, including a big company, some academic places. They just looked at file sizes of everyone's files and said, what do they typically look like? And this is a CDF. So for example, for the web data set they had, over 90% of files were less than 10 kilobytes. Over like 99% of those files were less than 100 kilobytes. And for this NT workload they had, about over 70% of the files were less than 10 kilobytes. And you can see sort of the big trend here is that most files are pretty small. And this has happened every time people have looked at this sort of data, is that most files are pretty small. Maybe this is changing today. But when the file systems were designed, that's what the file system designers were looking at. Most files are pretty small, often less than a kilobyte, often less than 10 kilobytes. And this is the motivation for having those direct pointers in the inode, that for most files, that's going to be plenty. And you can just choose a number of direct pointers there such that almost all files won't use indirect pointers. Of course, large files are still important, and they're what people probably care about their file system most for because they notice the most. So you still want to support them well, you still need to support them, but optimizing for small files, that's why we have this organization with direct pointers. It's because small files are so much more common, we want to support them more efficiently. We don't want to have extra indirection for small files, which is going to be almost all of our files. And we don't want to use like two or three layers of indirection when one will do for medium-sized files, which are going to be much more common than our large, very large files. Yes? Can I explain in the last example how 2 to the 15 was used? So 2 to the 15 is 32 kilobytes. And each block was 1 kilobyte, so that's 32 blocks. So if I ask where to get to byte 0, that's the beginning of the file, byte 1, 2, 3, yeah. So, okay. Now, the scheme we have here for storing large files, it works, and it does allow random access to the files much better than FAT, but it still might be disappointing to you, both because we have to store a lot of extra data to store where files are, not as much as in FAT probably, or I guess almost about as much as in FAT, because FAT stores the next pointers, and we're storing roughly the same amount of space, just in a different location. But it still seems like pretty inconvenient to actually access a whole file, right? We have to read a lot of extra stuff to figure out where the file is. So there's a common solution that file systems do called extents, where instead of storing an array of block numbers, we store an array or a list or a tree of a start block number and a size. And we say that we're going to allocate not one block at a time, but groups of blocks. And ideally, this would mean that if we have a gigabyte file, we just say it starts at block 1,000 of the disk and goes for the next million blocks. And this scheme would let us do that. And many modern file systems actually do support this, in addition or to or instead of the scheme of having separate pointers to each block of the file. So the question is, why don't we just use this more often? Why wasn't this the default? And the big problem is allocating these extents is very challenging. We have to find, if we want to use extents efficiently, we have to find a bunch of blocks that are free right next to each other. And if the disk has been used a bunch, there's no guarantee that exists. And in the worst case, we have to allocate like lots of little extents and have a list of them, which is going to be as bad as having an array of block pointers, right? Or possibly worse, because it's more complicated to like find how to seek to the middle of it. But it's worth saving all that metadata space, so lots of file systems try to do this, but to support this, they need to figure out how to find big contiguous unused space on the disk, which all our other stuff kind of didn't require. Some questions about extents? Yes?
How exactly does this solve the problem with the majority of things being small?
Question, how does this solve the problem with the majority of things being small? It doesn't. But it deals with large files. And one of the advantages of dealing with this a separate scheme for large files is that there's this tension here. Large files, for efficiency, you want to have large block sizes. For small files, for efficiency, you want to have small block sizes. And having a separate scheme for large files gives you less pressure to have really large block sizes. And the reason why you want large block sizes for large files is it means you have less block pointers to store. Right, and that's a concern for large files. For small files, that's not a big deal. For small files, you want to waste less space in your blocks by having smaller blocks. What I mean by replaces or supplements the block list? So an example of a scheme you would use for this is you'd have an entry in the inode which says, don't interpret the adders array as a list of blocks, interpret it as a list of these pairs. And the OS would turn that on for large files, but not for small ones. How does that help? So this allows us, we're just storing extra information. So the information we're storing here allows us to say with one entry, here's a gigabyte of data. With block pointers, to store a gigabyte of to point to a gigabyte of data, we need to have thousands of pointers. Does that answer your question? Okay, back there. Question, for extents, are the clusters essentially a variable size? So the blocks are still going to be fixed size when we're using extents. We're just going to allocate multiple at once is how it's going to work. But importantly, we still have to track what blocks are free, and we're going to still do that on a block-by-block basis.
Okay, wait, so would the blocks be allocated once, would they all be contiguous?
Question, would the blocks be allocated once, would they all be contiguous? If we allocate contiguous blocks, our list of these pairs will be just one entry, right? If we can't do that, we're going to have multiple of them, and that's going to be less efficient. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
But why is it not the case that having contiguous memory is a prerequisite for extents?
Why is it not the case that having contiguous blocks free is a prerequisite for extents? Because we can store a list of these. So if we have two different, if we can allocate our big file in 20 different chunks, we can store a list of 20 extents to represent that.
So it's just making it faster to read stuff by storing information where you're reading it rather than having to read it.
Question is just making it faster to read stuff by storing the information where we're reading it. So we're storing, this is what we're storing on the disk still. We're just saying, if we have a contiguous blocks allocated, I don't need to store 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I can store 1 and comma 6. And that's what I'm going to do. That only works if I can have mostly contiguous blocks in my file. It works either way, but it's only efficient if most of my file is contiguous on the disk. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. Well, that's extent. So in our last 10 minutes, and probably at the beginning of next time, we're going to talk a little about reliability. So one thing file systems are really concerned about is if I have a crash, if I lose power or something fails, what's going to be the state of my file system? And so the answer to this is useful to know, well, what happens when I interrupt a hard drive or solid state disk write? What's going to happen? And the way most hard drives or solid state disks at least claim to work is that either you write a whole sector or corrupt it or you do nothing. There's no in between, that you can't write half a sector. And the way this is implemented typically is that most hard drives and solid state disks have a checksum, sort of a hash of the sector's contents. And if that doesn't match, they just tell you when you try to read it, sorry, this sector isn't available. So this means if I write out a sector on the disk, I'm going to get either that whole sector written or nothing. I'm not going to write half the sector when I see half of what I wrote back only. I'm going to see all of it or none of it. So this is going to be important when we're talking about what's going to happen when things fail. And there's a bunch of reliability issues we could talk about. We're going to focus on having the file system be in a consistent state. So for example, I want to know what blocks are free. I don't want to have space allocated and but not actually assigned to a file. I don't want to have files have blocks assigned to them, but they're marked as free. So when I make a new file, I overwrite them. That would be really bad. I want to make sure that if I have a file specified in a directory that the data is actually there, that it doesn't point to junk. That I got a chance to write it when I wrote that file, directory entry. I'm not going to have the file that contains nonsense. There are other things we could be concerned about that we probably won't talk about this semester, that are other reliability issues. So one thing is, what if like my storage fails totally? I might want to like store data across two different disks. So that's something that operating systems can do. One common scheme for that's called RAID. That having data mirrored on two disks, for example, or more than two disks. Also, dealing with what if I accidentally delete a file, can I have a backup saved automatically? And there's something that where file systems can store multiple versions, something called snapshotting, that's useful for that. Want to mention they exist, you know, but we're not going to talk about how you implement these features. Okay. So let's look at our reliability consistency problem. And let's think of moving a file from one directory to another on XV6. So what we're going to do is we're going to write a new directory entry and overwrite an old directory entry. And I told you that writing sectors like happens all or not. So we have basically two sectors we need to modify here. So let's say I do A and then B, right? So it's either I'm going to replace A or I'm not, and replace B and I'm not. So let's say I do A before B, and a crash happens after I do A. Well, in that case, I have two directory entries that point to the same file. But if I remove that one of those files from the directory, I'm going to remove the original file and like let it be replaced with other stuff. So that's pretty bad. Right? Because I have two pointers to the file, I remove one of them, I say, oh, the file's going away. Now I've deleted a file that's actually in another directory. So that other file won't work. Let's say I do the other reason. If I overwrite the old directory entry to remove it, and then write the new one, if I have a crash after I do the overwriting, now the files disappear totally. So both of these are pretty bad. Right? These are things we don't want to happen on a crash. We don't want to have a file which will disappear when I remove another file and get corrupted, and I don't want to have a file that I was moving like be missing totally. But if we don't do some extra steps, that's what's going to happen. And so there's a trick that we're going to use that's going to be take advantage of the fact that updating a sector is atomic, where basically what we want to do is we want to be able to have either the file be moved or not moved. We don't want to have any in-between states. And we're going to make the file system work this way by redesigning our file system setup such that writing to one place is going to do this entire move. That there's going to be one sector we modify, and if that modification happens, the file's moved. If not, it's not moved. And I'll talk about how we do that. And we're going to have this general idea of a concept of a transaction, that which is going to be a bunch of updates that happen all at once or not at all. And the general implementation strategy we're going to use for this is we're going to write out what our transaction is, and we're going to have one update which will say commits the transaction. And if that's there, we're going to make sure that whole transaction happens. And if it's not there, we're going to make sure none of the transaction happens. Questions? Yeah?
Can you explain that one more time? I just didn't.
So a transaction is going to be a bunch of updates we want to happen all at once or not at all. And the way we're going to implement it is we're going to plan our updates, and we're going to have one update that indicates whether, yes, all these updates happen, or no, they don't. And we're going to enforce that. And that update, we're going to say, commits the transaction. That if it's there, it's going to happen. If it's not there, it's not going to happen. Okay. And the way we're going to do this is with a lock. So the technique I'm going to talk about for implementing transactions, there's a bunch of them. I'm going to talk about just one, which is called redo logging. And we'll see why it's called redo logging in a bit. So let's say we want to create a file, and we want that to be a transaction. We want the file to be created all at once. We don't want to have the different parts of the file creation happen separately. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a log. And to this log, which in XV6 is stored near the beginning of the disk. I'm going to write all the things I want to do to create the file. I'm going to update an inode to point to set to have the metadata for that file. I'm going to write some data blocks to update a directory entry and put the file's data there. I'm going to update the free map. So I have all the operations I'm doing to update the file, or to create the file in my log. And I write these to the log before I ever touch the rest of the disk. So I haven't touched any other part of the disk. I've just written to the log, here's an operation I'd like to do. Then I write to the log that I've committed this. This is my commit operation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that if I wrote commit to the log, that these updates definitely happen. How am I going to do that? When we boot up, I'm going to check the log, and I'm going to do everything that the log says I promised to do. So in the event that I didn't get around to, before we had a crash, to actually doing all the parts of file creation, I'm going to read the log, and I'm going to say, oh, I better update this directory entry. I better put the file's data here. I better update the inode. I better update the free map because I have this commit here. I promised that I would do that. And this is called redo logging because when things don't crash, or when we crash after we do these operations, we're doing them over again. We crashed before, we're doing them the first time, but often we'll do things over again, and that's okay. Questions? Yeah?
So does the log maintain the order of transactions?
Question, does the log maintain the order of transactions? That's probably a more complicated topic than this class will cover, but it can. Does that answer your question? Yes. Can I crash in the middle of logging? Yes. So if I crash here while I'm writing here, basically the file just won't be created at all. If I crash after I write the commit, we're going to redo the operations no matter what. Does that answer your question? Is it because it's atomic? It's because writing this commit here is atomic. Right, this either happens all at once or not at all. We can't have a partially commit. It's going to be commit or not. Okay, yes?
So let's say it doesn't crash and you do this stuff correctly, then like if it's going back to the log, would it look for the last entry?
So the question is, what do we do if it didn't crash? And what I'm going to do is eventually I'm going to have some process to free up stuff in the log that I've already actually written elsewhere on the disk. So eventually I'll get to actually freeing up space in the log, but if before that, we'll just redo them even if it's already done. Yes?
I may have said you wrong, but did you say that if we crash after the commit, then the file doesn't get created?
What question, if I just say after if we crash after the commit, the file doesn't create it. If we crash before the commit, the file doesn't create it. If we crash after, it will be because we'll redo the creation. So sort of, and we just divide our operations up in this way so we can have more transactions in the log. So our log will just have a series of begin, do this operation, commit over and over. And at some point, we're going to apply things that we promised to do in the log to the disk. We can do that at our leisure. But we don't need to actually do that right away. As long as they happen eventually, you know, so we can free up space in the log, it's fine. If we have a crash after we've written something to the log, we know it's going to happen anyways from reboot, the boot process. And eventually, we're going to free up log space once we know that we no longer need something in the log to make sure that like that file is created. If the file is already written everywhere else, we can free up that space in the log for something else. So sort of our normal operation is going to be we write what we're going to do to the log. We write that we're committing. Then we do all our updates, and then we free up the space in the log. And if we have a crash before we write the commit, we just don't do any of these operations. We have after, we're going to redo them. So our sort of reboot procedure is we ignore things without a commit, everything with a commit we do again. Possibly twice, but that's not going to be a problem. Yes?
And if we crash during logging, how do we avoid that causing problems?
Question, if we crash during logging, as long as, because we write commit after everything else, that shouldn't be either we're going to have a commit and a full thing of list of things to do, or we're going to have no commit and we just ignore the partial list.
But what if we like needed that to happen in order for the program to continue executing?
Question, what if we needed that to happen for, in order for the program to continue executing? Then we better have waited to, for the commit message to be written. Does that answer your question?
Well, if, like, is there something that if we crashed during the log that would go restart writing that log? Is there some mechanism to do that?
So if we crashed during the log, is there something that would restart writing that log? Not particularly. So not by crash, I mean not that like a program crashes. I mean the entire system crashes.
Yeah.
So generally, we're not going to be in a good state on a crash. OK, so I'll finish up there. See you. We'll finish up this topic next time.